of Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. Protesters shouted anti-US and Israeli slogans and denounced all those who are supporting the continuous Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip.
No matter how many people betray the people of Palestine, and no matter how many presidents and governments side with the Israeli regime, the people of Yemen are ready to support Palestine with money, weapons, and we are also ready to fight alongside our Palestinian brothers.
Prominent Ansarullah official Muhammad Ali al-Houthi also slammed the Arab and Islamic world's reluctance to take meaningful actions against Israel to save the lives of Gazans.
The Arab and Islamic world is outraged with what they are seeing in Palestine. We continue to watch the sad and depressing footage coming out of Palestine, but we need to take more actions in every aspect. As the leader of the revolution has said, we need to mobilize more in protesting in our media coverage and also militarily.
Muhammad Ali also addressed U.S. latest plan to form a NATO-like coalition force to protect the Red Sea.
Today, America is calling for the formation of a big coalition which should also include Arab regimes for the protection of the Red Sea. However, we tell those who are thinking about protecting the Red Sea to first protect the Rafah borders before sending your armies against your brothers.
For the time being, Yemen's armed forces will continue to target Israel with drones and ballistic missiles. This in addition to the targeting of any ships linked to the Israeli regime attempting to cross Yemen's Bab al-Mandeb Strait.
The Yemeni armed forces are calling on residents in occupied Palestine to evacuate all areas near Israeli military sites because these are considered legit military targets as long as the regime's onslaught continues on the besieged Gaza Strip. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
Since the beginning of Israeli aggression on Gaza, the Indian news channels have been busy debating and only promoting the Israeli side of the narrative. However, protests, gatherings or discussions on Israeli genocide against Palestinians have been strictly forbidden, including in schools, colleges and universities. Experts say this could lead to a greater suppression of Muslims in India and further escalation of Islamophobia.
Islamophobia in India has increased in last 10-20 years to an extent that anything which is related to Muslims or Islam is seen with suspicion, even hatred. And that's why if you say something which is seen as being sympathetic to Palestinians, that would not be allowed.
Despite Palestinian plight being suppressed in this part of the world, there are many who leave no stone unturned to highlight the issue and enlighten the masses about the real history of the aggression. A case in point was this seminar organized to address human rights violations across the globe, particularly against women and children. The speakers, mostly women, blasted the utter failure of the United Nations to put an end to the Gaza carnage. The participants of the seminar condemned the Israeli onslaught on Gaza, calling it ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
It's also part of a much longer standing suppression of dissent over the last decade, since the BJP came to power, where various events on campus have been cancelled. So anything to do with the constitution, with discussions of human rights, democracy, Kashmir, Maoism, all of these have become taboo subjects. So Palestine has been added to the list of taboo subjects. So there are four reasons. There's a technological arms reason, there's the ideological reason, there's the Islamophobia reason, and there's the longer suppression of dissent reason.
Observers say it's not just the issue of Palestine that is being barred in the academics or criminalized in the public spheres, but the issues related to the Muslims of the country are being sidelined and seen in the prism of rising Islamophobia. Experts say the term Muslim or Islam has become a political tool since decades to garner votes ahead of elections by polarizing voters. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Yeah. Millay University in Kabul has hosted a pro-Palestine conference dubbed Palestine and the Responsibilities of Islamic Nations, with attendees including religious scholars, Taliban authorities, university lecturers, and students, discussing the pressing issue of Palestine. Participants voiced their concern and support for Gazans in the face of Israeli brutal aggression, while calling for unity among Muslims. During the conference, rights activists took the stage to draw attention to the egregious human rights violations and atrocities perpetrated by Israel against the Palestinians. They vehemently condemned international inaction and accused the global community of complicity in Israel's crimes. Urging for immediate action, they emphasized the need to exert greater pressure and take concrete steps to bring an end to the occupation and siege in the Palestinian territories. This conference is a means for Afghans to show their support for Palestine. They also urge other Muslims around the world to unite for the cause and victory of Palestinians. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The heads of key religio-political parties and top clerics took part in a national conference titled Security of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Responsibility of Muslims in the Pakistani capital Islamabad on Wednesday. In a collective stance, the heads of religious groups and leaders of political parties designated December 8th as the National Day of Protection of Al-Aqsa Mosque, during which they intend to stage nationwide protests to denounce Israel's massacres in Gaza. With the primary objective of tackling security concerns surrounding Al-Aqsa Mosque, the conference has highlighted the importance of preserving the sanctity of this holy site, acknowledging its significance for Muslims worldwide.
We want to tell our government, along with the leaders of Islamic states, that we will not allow anyone to recognize Israel as a legitimate state. The people of the US and the UK have expressed their support for Palestine by holding historic mass protests against Israel's barbarism in Gaza. If the West respects democracy and public opinion, they should immediately withdraw their support from Israel.
The participants in the event united in their condemnation of the Israeli aggression on Gaza, underscoring a shared commitment to find diplomatic solutions to the long-standing conflict.
The genocide of Palestinians in Gaza is being carried out on a daily basis. The US and Israel are directly responsible for this mass killing. The streets of Gaza will be turned into a graveyard for the Zionist regime in the near future.
Speakers at the conference have referred to massive civilian casualties, infrastructure damage, and the overall humanitarian crisis in the region.
Nobody was watching the atrocities which were being committed before this also. State terrorism. I think it is never seen before in the history of the world. I would go back to Germany, and maybe it is worse than that, because this kind of bombing was not seen anywhere in the world.
The participants at the conference not only reaffirmed their unwavering commitment to safeguarding the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque, but also made it clear that they are determined to intensify efforts aimed at achieving a complete halt to Israel's aggressive actions in Gaza. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
The Islamic Radios and Television Union held a conference in Beirut to denounce the killing of journalists in Palestine and Lebanon and to voice support for the Palestinian people and resistance. The speakers all stressed that the battle of the media is complementary to that of the resistance.
Our media battle is decisive. It began as a very brutal war against us when they tried to portray Hamas as Daesh or ISIS. They slammed any act of resistance against Israel as an aggression and propagated the idea that Hamas kills children and rapes women, and then they tried to sell them to the world. But with God's help and our steadfastness and the strength of our media, their campaign has backfired, and we now see the support of the people in all capitals of the world for Palestine.
The conference also included videos of the correspondents on the field in Gaza, who have transcended all borders and, despite the misinformation campaign, conveyed the truth to the rest of the world.
The resistance media has succeeded despite its limited capacity, since it is always dependent on the truth. The theory attributed to a former German foreign minister is that if you keep repeating a lie, others will eventually believe it. Such a theory could have been possible during a period in history when there was no awareness or knowledge or technology. But today, everyone can recognize the truth. Look where the lies of the U.S. and Israeli have gotten them. The most important power we have now is the truth.
Influential figures and experts stress that the next phase is pivotal and that the alternative media need to work on promoting the narrative of the free people of the world on a global scale.
The Israeli regime was too late to notice that the resistance was able to let its narrative be heard. And I can tell you with all certainty, and despite all the misinformation and deception practiced for over a month and a half, that the narrative of the resistance and its media has been established. What's important now is how to preserve it. Now this narrative is strong and has spread across the world, but we need to maintain it.
I believe the world is now ready to listen, to look and ponder on the other point of view and the other side of the story. We need to think about what is the discourse that we need to present to the world, what are its terminology and its context. This is part of the meetings and plans for the next phase. That is why it is pivotal to hold such conferences.
Israel has killed over 60 journalists, including female reporters in Gaza, and three in southern Lebanon. Israel has attempted to portray itself as an entity trying to defend itself. Yet the journalists who have put their lives in the line of fire in Gaza have debunked these claims and have shown that it is the Palestinian people who have the right to defend themselves. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Held to coincide with the 10th anniversary of the demise of South African anti-apartheid icon Nelson Mandela, the 5th Convention of Solidarity with Palestine reiterated the right to resist, as struggles globally have proved the effectiveness of a multi-pronged approach to confront oppression and the colonial project.
From the river to the sea!
Hosted by Mandla Mandela, the grandson of Nelson Mandela, he recalled how his grandfather galvanized the support of frontline African states to support an effective resistance against the apartheid regime. He noted that Arab countries must adopt a similar position and shoulder their responsibility. The conference also heard that Mandela himself was called a terrorist when he resisted oppression.
He also raised arms for the African National Congress. We therefore call on each and everyone in this conference to ensure that you adopt Nelson Mandela's way. Go to your countries, mobilize resources, mobilize arms for the Palestinian resistance to effectively wage their struggle so that we can defeat the brutal apartheid regime of Israel.
Attended by a spectrum of movements from around the world, the conference considered the role of all spheres of society in activating awareness. In South Africa, for example, women and youth proved cornerstone of the resistance, often paving the way. But their cries and resolute steadfastness were heard and seen, which resulted in a global mobilization to act. Something participants say Arab countries have failed so far.
When I talk to you, I talk more in pain than in anger. We would have expected some Islamic countries who would say that they support the Palestinian cause to cut relations with the Israelis, as did South Africa, who is not an Islamic, not an Arabic country. Why they don't cut the relations with the Israelis? Why they continue to have trade with the Israelis up till now? Why? If they really have a position to say, to tell us, our people, go and make actions. We don't want to hear words.
South Africa's former intelligence minister, Ronnie Castrels, described America as the number one enemy of humanity and the key player behind the genocide in Gaza. To overcome Israel, therefore, is to confront the colonial project, racism and oppression.
The discussion panels held at the conference focused on three critical areas: civil society, media, and the international system. If used correctly, these domains can ensure that accurate information is conveyed and pressure is applied, leading to international bodies being able to take action to prosecute those guilty of atrocities in Palestine. Hassan Tariyab, Johannesburg.
A ceremonial meeting at the Moscow airport. The Iranian president was welcomed by Deputy Prime Minister of Russia, Alexander Novak. A guard of honor was lined up on the airfield. In the honor of Ibrahim Raisi's arrival, the national anthems of Russia and Iran were played. Such a warm welcome is a sign of respect for the Iranian president and the importance Russia attaches to its relations with the Islamic Republic. Stronger political ties will contribute to growth in bilateral trade.
In the context of our policy to develop relations with neighboring states, in particular with our friendly country, the Russian Federation, we are seeing clear progress in Tehran-Moscow cooperation, and these negotiations are designed to promote new favorable conditions for cooperation. Energy, agriculture, education, we can do even better in all these areas.
One of the issues that the two leaders discussed at the meeting was the construction of a railway that would complete the creation of the international north-south transport corridor. This is a 7,000 kilometers long route that goes from St. Petersburg to the Indian port of Mumbai. But even before the trip, Ibrahim Raisi referred to Israel's onslaught on Gaza as the main topic for negotiations.
Of course, it is very important for us to exchange views on what's happening in the region, especially regarding the situation in Palestine.
The bombing of the Gaza Strip must be stopped as soon as possible. This issue today is a problem not only for our region, but for all mankind. The whole world is suffering from unilateral measures and an unjust global system. We see a clear manifestation of this in the events taking place in Palestine. Israel's onslaught on Gaza amounts to genocide and crimes against humanity. These actions are supported by the United States and some other Western countries. It is regrettable that international organizations that are supposed to protect human rights have lost their effectiveness, and this is happening before the eyes of the entire world.
Russia attaches significance to discussing relations with Iran and exchanging views on regional issues, including Israel's onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Another topic of more than 5 hours negotiations between Putin and Raisi was energy. Iran, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia are members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. The two leaders will have the opportunity to meet again very soon. An agreement on the creation of a free trade zone between Iran and the Eurasian Economic Union is scheduled to be signed at the end of December. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
In the limelight.
Researchers have found that young people who entered Britain's labour market amid the 2008 financial crisis are still scarred by its impact on their employment and earnings potential. We take a look at the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. New research shows millennials in the United Kingdom are still bearing the economic scars of the 2008 financial crisis and are struggling to catch up with the living standards of older groups, while US officials claim their American counterparts have closed the gap. In its annual intergenerational audit, the Resolution Foundation compares the fortunes of millennials born between 1981 and 2000 with their predecessors, including Generation X, born between 1966 and 1980. It found that after the 2008 financial crisis and the ensuing recession, the long-running pattern that had seen young people earn more on average than their parents at the same stage of life had been broken. The report said millennials born in the late 1980s earned on average 8% less at age 30 than their counterparts when the Generation X cohort when they were at the same age. In the United States, by contrast, officials claim while the crisis also made a significant dent in millennials' earning power, recent income gains by younger workers have now helped them to catch up. Sophie Hale, the think tank's principal economist, said, "Young people across advanced economies were hit by the financial crisis of 2008, putting a stop to decades of progress. 15 years on, this crisis cohort are no longer young. And while other countries' millennials have bounced back, their counterparts in Britain are still wearing economic scars as they approach middle age. US millennials in their early 30s in 2021 were earning 21% more in real terms than people in the same age group were in 2007. However, in Britain, incomes were still 1% lower for this group than for the 30 to 34-year-olds 15 years earlier. Explaining the divergence, the report's authors pointed to long-term wage stagnation in the United Kingdom, which has been particularly bad for young graduates due to Britain's economy's inability to create enough skilled jobs. They wrote, "The typical weekly pay of university graduates aged between 30 and 34 has fallen by 16% between 2007 and 2023, while the typical weekly pay of non-graduates is down by only 6%. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Sky-high housing costs in Britain have also meant many millennials have struggled to afford their own home at the same age as their parents or grandparents. The Resolution Foundation found that there had been some catch-up in recent years, but the millennials still remain a long way behind. The report said, around the turn of the millennium, 67% of households aged 30 to 34 were homeowners. But by 2021, this figure was still 20 percentage points lower at 47%. However, US officials claim in their country, homeownership rates have fallen by much less. 56% of 30 to 34-year-olds owned their home 2 decades ago, and in 2021, it was 50%. Sophie Hale, a British economist, said the low home ownership rates in Britain meant that many millennials were forced to live in high-cost and often low-security private rented accommodation that further impedes their living standards. Darren Jones, Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury, said, "This report paints a stark picture of an economy that no longer works for working people," adding, 13 years of the Conservatives have left an entire generation falling behind their international counterparts and no better off than their parents' generation. Ben Twomey, Chief Executive of the campaign group Generation Rent, said the last 10 years had been a lost decade for housing in Britain. Ben Twomey added, "Policies like Help to Buy have only helped existing homeowners by increasing house prices. Most young adults continue to shell out excessive rents that make it harder to save for the future, while those lucky enough to have bought could only do so by taking on large debts and are now facing crushing increases in mortgage payments." Ben Twomey added, "At least now there is action to make life better for renters through the Renters Reform Bill, but it needs to go further to give those of us locked out of home ownership the chance of a long-term home. The tough economic conditions endured by millennials may help to explain the fact that they appear not to have followed their forebears in moving to the political right as they have aged. A recent YouGov opinion poll suggested that just 12% of 25 to 49-year-olds intend to vote conservative at the next general election. The Center for Policy Studies, a right-wing think tank, has published a new collection of essays titled Justice for the Young that call for policies to help close the generation gap, including cheaper childcare and reform of student loans. Its director, Robert Colville, said, "The divide between the young and the old is becoming Britain's defining characteristic, not just politically, but economically as well." The website of CNBC has also covered this same story and tells us more. Researchers found young people who entered Britain's labour market amid the 2008 financial crisis are still scarred by its impact on their employment and earnings potential. According to a new report, the so-called crisis cohort who entered the world of work following the financial meltdown of 2008 have continued to face higher unemployment, lower pay, and worse job prospects more than a decade later. Published recently by the British think tank, the Resolution Foundation, the study says that while Britain avoided a repeat of the mass youth unemployment seen in the 1980s, the impact of the financial crisis in 2008 was spread more evenly across young people, mostly in the form of a prolonged squeeze on pay. Low-skilled workers who left education during 2008 and 2011 were 30% less likely to find employment than before the downturn. And researchers said the effect lasted for almost a decade. However, the report noted that the lowest paid were afforded some protection by the minimum wage. Meanwhile, graduates who entered Britain's labour market during the same period were a third more likely to be in low-paid work up to 7 years on from the downturn. According to the report, this group of graduates were paid 6% less than graduates who entered the workforce before the downturn, with their wages taking up to 7 years to recover. According to the report, this matters because time spent in low-paying occupations reduces someone's future earnings prospects, not just because pay progression is weaker in these occupations, but also because moving to higher-paying occupations is relatively rare and pay effects do not immediately unwind when and if someone does. The Resolution Foundation urged policymakers to focus on the lasting effects of the financial crisis on young people's prospects, adding that Britain's lawmakers should be preparing for the next economic downturn. Stephen Clark, senior economic analyst at Resolution Foundation think tank, said in a recent press release that people who entered the world of work amid the financial crisis were still facing significant scarring effects. He added, "Low-skilled workers faced a higher risk of unemployment, while university graduates were more likely to trade down the types of jobs they did, with their pay and prospects stunted as a result." Stephen Clark added, "These scarring effects have stayed with the crisis cohort for up to a decade, reducing their living standards at a time when they may be facing the additional financial strains of buying a home or bringing up young children."
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Tell me, name me one more nation, any other nation that's doing as much as the United States to alleviate the pain and suffering of the people of Gaza. You can't. You just can't. Believe it or not, this was said by U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby. It is so outrageous we could even laugh if it wasn't for the fact that the reality is so dark and completely opposite, and that it is the United States is doing all it can to increase the pain, to increase the suffering of the people of Gaza, and is responsible for the murder of over 17,700 people. We're going to talk and look at this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Elijah Mackey, a journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And Daniel Yigic, author and researcher out of Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Well, let me start this off with Elijah. Now, it is as if everything is being made a mockery of. For example, the U.S. is alleviating the suffering of the people of Gaza, just like international law isn't really a reality. I mean, how do you see all of this, Elijah?
We have seen at the United Nations yesterday how 13 countries supported the humanitarian ceasefire because it is called humanitarian ceasefire, while the UK, one of the closest US allies, abstained and the US just rejected the vote. And that means how much the US is indeed supporting genocidal killing and murdering of the children and women in Gaza, the destruction of the infrastructure, the violation of international laws, and the committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. That is undoubtedly the participation, direct participation of the US to all the genocide that is happening in Gaza, and the Americans really don't care. Now, what is important here is the awareness of the population around the world can no longer swallow any of the American narrative that they are working for peace because they prove to be unworthy of being a partner for peace. We've seen how President Vladimir Putin was received in the Emirates and Saudi Arabia, one of the very close allies to the US, how he received President Ibrahim Raisi in Moscow and the strategic relationship. Because another world, another model is forming itself because the hegemony of the U.S. is no longer valid, is no longer human. It is supportive of the Israeli Zionist killing of a small population in a very small, tiny area of Palestine, and is still talking about the possibility of having two states, which is another mockery. So I don't think the Americans care really about the humanitarian aspect of this conflict. Nevertheless, they still have the guts to come out and say, like Secretary Blinken said a few days ago, that he determined that in Sudan there is a violation of humanitarian laws, which means these people are completely cut off from the reality, and they have lost all the sensibility toward humanity. So there's nothing to be done about the Americans. This is why there is a need of a new system, a worldwide system, where the Americans cannot veto a humanitarian aspect like the ceasefire in Gaza.
Yes, indeed. The hypocrisy is absolutely amazing. Well, Daniel, your take on how the United States, I mean, could even veto this UN resolution that was urging an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. I mean, what does it mean? At least before, there was some semblance, they wanted to show a little semblance of trying to be fair, whether they were or not. There was a cover. But it seems as if now they don't care. They absolutely don't care. Your take.
I agree. It really seems like they don't care, and also they don't have to care, because we are now in the third month of the genocide, and the Zionist regime is getting away with killing more and more Palestinians and continuing live on camera for the entire world to watch this genocide without any intervention. And the one power that could immediately stop this genocide is the United States. And it is continuing to not just be complicit, but to support this genocide. Because at the end of the day, the United States is not only a sponsor in this sponsor-proxy relationship with Tel Aviv and with the Zionist regime, but also Palestinians are victims of a genocide that's being carried out by the West, if we talk about the United States and the European Union and their allies, because, of course, the existence of the Israeli regime depends on this external aid and continuous support that it receives from the West. So, of course, it is to some extent in the U.S. interest to keep the situation going. At the same time, there is, of course, no justification. And the United States, in the current political discourse that it's employing, keeps using the same words and pretending as if it was, to some extent, concerned about human rights and the international law in other situations, but not in Palestine, which also, again, shows us that Zionism is part and parcel of U.S. Foreign policy and, to some extent, political identity, and Zionism can only exist through these genocidal actions. And at the same time, Palestinians are not considered human necessarily. They are not considered in this discourse as human beings who would be worthy of this elementary protection that could be extended to them under international law.
Right. Well, Elijah, as Israel calls for northern Gaza to be exclusive for Palestinian, the U.S. looks the other way. I mean, is there any way that Israel could do what it is doing without the help and approval of the United States?
Absolutely not. First of all, it is not only the approval. We've seen the Americans supporting the Israelis by sending 45,000 bombs. Today, the Pentagon approved of sending 14,000 tank shells from their strategic warehouse. They are direct participants to the genocide. Secondly, the Americans from day one, Secretary Blinken came to Israel and said, I am not here representing the U.S. government. I am here as a Jew, like if the war was a religious one, which indicates the idiotic level of this narrative. It is a conflict that has been going on for the last 75 years about the right of land, of territory. It is not about the religion. Thirdly, Joe Biden, when he arrived to the U.S., he had a press conference saying, you have the legitimacy and the right to do what you are going to do. So he gave him the full authority to Benjamin Netanyahu to do what he's wanting to do. And the last point here I would like to point out is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu coming out on television yesterday and saying to the world, threatening the world, if you take us in front of an international court, you are anti-Semite. If you do that, you are Holocaust denial. If you try to incriminate us, you are a genocidal denial. You are Jew hater. So he basically said to the whole West, if you want to keep your position where you are, you have to stand by us and stop all this nonsense about the war crime and crimes against humanity, because we have the right to do whatever we want. And all the cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu say from the first days, don't lecture us. We're going to cut water, electricity, everything. So they have recognized all the crimes against humanity publicly on television, careless about the world reaction and all the international law, the Geneva Convention, the Hague, all the law that are in place, including the United Nations articles and protection of the civilians, including the Palestinians. So we see this is no complicity. It is a direct action in the killing of the Palestinian. And on top of that, the Americans are, they have 2,000 Delta forces in Israel supporting the Israelis. They are flying drones. They are giving a bridge between the United States and Israel to supply all the weapons. They are working from Cyprus with the British to monitor and support Israel with intelligent information. They are a direct participant in everything.
So would you say, staying with you, Elijah, just really quick, so would you say this is actually a war, the United States war against the Palestinians?
It is indeed. And the Palestinians, the Americans will only call for a ceasefire when Israel wants. This is my experience in all the war that Israel has waged in Lebanon and against the Palestinians. When the Israelis are ready, then the Americans will be ready to accommodate them at the United Nations.
Okay. So, yes, well, let me get Daniel back in on this discussion. Daniel, what about that? Do you agree with what Elijah said? Is it when Israel is ready, or is it when the United States is ready that Israel will follow suit? I mean, we're trying to figure out who's leading whom here, because the United States definitely not only supports the regime diplomatically, politically, militarily, and constantly showing it and non-apologetically. So how do you see it?
Exactly. It's a good question. Who is actually having more influence over whom? And so, of course, if we look into the history of Zionism, the colony itself was always intended as a European outpost in this part of the world that would only be able to exist with external power, and the United States is the main sponsor of the Israeli regime. So on the one side, the existence of the Israeli regime is tied to this continuous U.S. support. And then the question again is, to what extent does this support of the genocide and the actual carrying out of the genocide by the United States against the Palestinians is in the strategic interest of the United States, because it is destroying a lot of its already fragile reputation that it had left in some parts of the region. And it is really, if we even look at currently in the last 2 months, the worldwide, including in the West, the protests in support of Palestine has become, one could argue, more visible than ever what the actual situation is in terms of settler colonialism and genocide. And the United States is very clearly showing that it's standing at the wrong side of history. But then, of course, we need to take into consideration the political power of Zionism in the United States that has a lot of influence on decision makers and policy makers and isn't working necessarily in the favor of the American people. So it is at the end, the political elite of both the sponsor, which is the U.S., and the colony and the proxy that the Zionist entity is, that are working together. But of course, the Israeli regime does have, to a certain extent, influence on the U.S., but we should also not forget that, in fact, Joe Biden, the U.S. president, has throughout the decades on record stated that he is a Zionist, that he's very proud of being a Zionist, and has even said that if Israel had not existed, the U.S. would have to create an Israel. So it is, I would say, an exchange of interest from both sides, in which the U.S. remains politically the stronger part.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Elisha, the latest veto by the U.S. comes against the backdrop of the regime's failure in achieving any of its objectives, including freeing its captives and destroying the Palestinian resistance, more than 2 months into the devastating war on Gaza. I mean, your assessment of all of this when we look at the situation at hand.
So far, in 64 days, the Israelis have achieved nothing. They have 100,000 men. They have 400 tanks, and they have managed to occupy part of Gaza. Now, there is a big difference between occupying and controlling. Occupying meaning be able to break into the territory, and controlling being able to control it and stop all resistance, which is not the case. The Israelis are losing every day between 5 to 15 officers and soldiers. They are losing tanks and armed vehicles. They are every single day having very high casualties. They are hit in the heart of the north that they have occupied 50 days ago. So they have in control nothing of Gaza. They don't understand, for example, in the north as Shuja'iyah. It is called Shuja'iyah because it derived from the Arab word of Shuja', that is courageous. They are the most courageous people in Gaza that are fighting them today and inflicting very heavy damage on the Israelis. So we see Israel has achieved nothing of its objective, trying to liberate one of the soldier prisoners. They have failed, end up killing the soldiers and losing two lives. So everything the Israelis are doing today, they are extremely embarrassed in front of their people. They have lost, to the, according to the information from Haaretz today, 5,000 men wounded. If this is true, and if it's not, if it is the complete number, which is always doubtful because the Israelis don't release all the figures. So in urban fighting, we have at least 2,000 soldiers killed if we have 5,000 wounded. So far, they have lost much more than what they have lost in 1967. And they are very close coming to what they have lost in 1973, the war against four armies. Hamas defeated the unbreakable, the army that is invincible on the 7th of October, and continue defeating it every single day. And this is why we understand why the Israelis are carpet bombing Gaza and why they're killing so many civilians, because this is the only thing they can achieve, is to kill children and women. But when they are confronted with the men of Gaza, they run away and they are taking so many casualties. They are unable to advance in an area that is 12 kilometers wide and 41 long.
Right, right. Well, Daniel, when we look at the situation of the United States, we see, instead, of course, the United States condemning the Israeli regime for its crimes, we see the United States, the Congress, basically trying to make certain things illegal, trying to say that Zionism is the same as being anti-Zionist is the same as being anti-Semitic. Also, we see movements trying to make from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, illegal, basically saying that when you say that, you're actually calling for the destruction of Israel, while at the same time, the Israelis are destroying Gaza. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling. Your thoughts?
I agree. And so we've seen it also in recent years before the current episode of the genocide, in which lawmakers in the U.S., but also in certain European countries to some extent, have tried to criminalize dissent, to criminalize boycott against the Israeli regime, and to call the mere resistance of Palestinians anti-Semitic to an extent where even now we are in a situation which would be ridiculous if it weren't that dangerous, where almost the not supporting genocide could get someone accused of anti-Semitism. And this, of course, not only harms Palestinians and dehumanizes and demonizes them and tries to portray the mere resistance as something racist or evil, when in fact it is Palestinians fighting against racism. Because at the end of the day, Palestinians in Gaza are being killed because they are not Jewish, because they are not a part of this racial hierarchy that the Israeli regime has constructed. And at the same time, of course, it is dangerous because there is a history of anti-Semitism, which had resulted including in the Holocaust. So it is very dangerous to actually relativize historical developments and actually existing forms of racism for a political gain that would further marginalize right. Palestinians and call people who are literally in a concentration camp that Gaza is being bombarded 24/7, calling them anti-Semitic, that is racist, just for merely existing. I think it is dangerous in many, many ways, and it's just another way of trying to silence people who are actually seeking justice.
Well, Elijah, I have about 1 minute, but your perspective, I mean, given the situation at hand and everything that we have seen, is there any alternative for the Palestinians in general, whether we're talking about Gaza or the West Bank? Is there any other alternative except resistance?
Well, the Palestinian resistance are still resisting. They're still very healthy. They have not stopped fighting. They haven't lost one single area. And the Palestinians want to continue. They want the Israelis to come into Gaza, because that prevents the Israelis from bombarding from afar and destroying more homes and destroying the infrastructure. Once the Israelis are very close and going into the street of Gaza, this is exactly where the resistance want them,